Hey guys, are you thinking about getting a new truck cover? You should be considering Diamondback Automotive Accessories. Got Diamondback covers is the truck covers that Philcraft Survival uses in all of our builds and open truck bed setups. Their 270, 180 can safely carry a dynamic load of 400 pounds, and the HD can safely carry a dynamic load of 1,600 pounds. In fact, I just got done talking to my marketing guy. It looks like we're going to build a Ford Ranger Raptor with a new Diamondback cover setup. You guys can go to diamondbackcovers.com. And on top of it all, if you're thinking about security, please don't put a tarp on the back of your truck bed. Use something that has the security and allows you to lock up all your belongings with the load-bearing capacity on top. That's what makes Diamondback covers the best. It's made in the U.S., ultra-durable, theft-protected, weather-protected, and world-class customer service. Check them out at diamondbackcovers.com. Okay. What's up, man?
Hey, what's going on?
Thanks for coming out.
Yeah, appreciate you having me.
How long have we been interoperating Philcraft and Anthem?
I think since we kicked off. It's been years. So I think in 2021, I came through you guys through Pat Lynch.
Yeah.
And I don't know, he reached out, you reached out, whatever the case was. And then you were so gracious, you put us on your Instagram feed and it was off and running. So
you guys have, I mean, I was just at Shields this weekend and you guys are there. You guys are everywhere.
Not everywhere, but
yeah, it seems like you guys are just like, well, I've never seen a company move so fast in a space. And I assume it's partly because of you, partly because of the team. And you just got this thing grinding. Talk to me about the Anthem Snacks story. How'd this whole thing begin with you?
Yeah. So I was living in Chicago at the time. I was in business school. I needed a break. I was coming off of working in the tech industry in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Had enough with that. Told my wife we're leaving. Went to business school, was in Chicago. I had a friend. We were just going to do something in entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Just want to start a business. I was like, I didn't want to work for anybody. I don't want to do any of that shit anymore. And, he had his dad was out in Montana looking for a second home. And he asked me if I had any interest in doing something out in Montana. And I told him, well, it depends what you want to do. So we came across this business broker who had these three meat processing plants that were for sale. And he presented it to us and he said, what do you think? And I was like, about what? I don't know shit about meat.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about the meat industry. I don't know.
He wanted you to buy them?
Yeah, he wanted us to buy them. So we were going to be investors with these three families. And he said, let's package this deal. What was going to be my business partner had really good connections on the coastal cities meat purveyors and restaurateurs and everything. And so we were going to brand Montana beef, do a grading, a designation, kind of like you think of a New Zealand lamb.
Yeah.
And we were going to do all the way through the supply chain for source verified. With everything going on with deforestation and everything going on in Brazil, we were like, we're going to tell the story all the way down to the rancher. And we're going to show, you know, because climate change was big and everything going on. And we were like, okay, put all that bullshit aside. Like, we're just going to tell all the way down to the rancher, and it's going to be American beef. And that's what we're going to sell, which was going to be, you know, an advantage for whatever restaurant was going to pick us up.
Yeah.
So that's the genesis of how it started. So I flew out. I had no intention of doing this. I flew out. I met with the families, and I just kind of fell in love with everything. I went to meat processing conventions. I met with the families. And I was going to be on, besides being an investor, I was going to be kind of more on the marketing side and telling their story.
Mm.
And so long story short, we tried to put this deal together, which was damn near impossible.
Well, I imagine those meat processing facilities are expensive. This is not cheap.
So they're all very old. So it's Montana, right? They're all state inspected, no USDA facilities at the time. They had maybe one.
Mm.
So you had to convert all these things to USDA. They were all built in like the 60s, you know. The next generation didn't want to take over for these things. They had gotten college degrees. They didn't want to stay in their little town. Mm. They wanted out. The labor shortage was tight over in Montana. So you started piecing all this together and you're like, okay, well, the families, we needed them to roll over their equity and become partners with us because we needed their expertise.
Yeah.
And you start talking to all of them. They're essentially negotiating against each other because they're valuing their own business relative to the business they are now going to get equity in.
Mm.
None of them want to work for each other. They're all kind of competitive. Like we said, the labor's tight, all this other stuff. And so my job at the time was I was going to go around the state and I was going to figure out how do we, besides the marketing and telling the story, how do we really kind of juice this thing, meaning there's so much state incentives for tax abatements, for credits, for hiring people, everything. They just don't know about it. They're just trying to keep the lights on.
Yeah, yeah.
And
because of mom and pop culture, like everything's a legacy,
everything's a legacy. They
word
run
of
these
mouth.
Businesses as kind of an ATM, right? So you had to kind of change all of this, all the philosophies, everything. And they do everything. They do poultry, they do beef, they do pork, they do game, they do custom, and they're all doing the same stuff. So you have to convince them, hey, listen, we shouldn't all be doing the same stuff. Each plant should specialize in what they're doing. You can't do custom because you can't get the throughput through the facility to get the numbers you want to get.
Yeah.
So it was really tough putting this deal together. And then in the process of talking to everybody at the state, I learned how difficult it was to do really anything in Montana at that time. They were all state inspected, like we said. The labor was tight. And the issue was they don't have the infrastructure there. Most of the cattle, I mean like 90%+, get shipped across state lines to get finished.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the kill facilities. They don't have the feedlots. It was cheaper to send the cattle to Kansas or Nebraska than to bring the grain to the cattle.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So you do all this work and you can't even call it Montana beef because they're not finished in Montana.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was like, so you start putting all this together and then the deal started falling apart. I didn't say I wasted. I spent 8 months doing this. And I, at the time I was like, did I just waste 8 months? I mean, I brought my wife out to, you know, we were living in Billings at the time, Billings, Montana.
Ooh, Billings is rough.
Yeah, Billings is interesting.
My favorite cowboy hats, Rands out of Billings. Really nice
hats.
I love that. Really nice hats.
Yeah, but, and a really good town. It's just not really what we were looking for.
Yeah, it's not even what you think of Montana as being.
No, it's not.
You can't even see a mountain. And
yeah, it's crazy, Billings. Right?
It's
crazy. So, you know, I had to really just kind of come to grips. I was like, I'm either going to stay here and do something, which I wasn't sure how you could do anything in Montana. There's not a lot of industry in Montana outside of agriculture and stuff. So it's not like there's a lot of big businesses.
Yeah.
Or I need to invest in one of these plants or start my own thing. And so after going to the meat processing conventions, learning enough about kind of what goes on. Let me back up. The other thing I learned in going through this process was when you run a meat processor, you have to sell everything. Like it sounds sexy when you're going to sell the cuts and all that to restaurants, but you have to sell everything down to the bones for dog treats. You've got to keep the lights on.
To break even.
Just to break even.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you have a vision of what you think this company is going to look like. It's a premium brand, all this stuff. But at the end of the day, you have to make choices just to keep the lights on. And you start to compromise your vision just for paying the bills.
Survival.
Yep, just for survival.
Yeah.
And so that was the one thing I got out of this. I learned that piece of it. And I said, okay, I'm going to focus on one value added product. I'm just going to lean into that. Instead of telling their story, it'll be somewhat my story.
Mm.
And we'll just see if this thing has legs.
So a marketing distribution, that was your focus versus the back end.
Yeah. I always figured, look, you could still do the back end, but why would I, you know, a plant is $10 million plus, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And it's a lot of work and you're not going to catch up on 40 years of industry knowledge day one. You're going to make a lot of mistakes, right? Yeah. So to me, it was like, well, if you get the brand right, everything you mentioned, marketing, distribution, all that, on the back end, you could then go successfully open up a state-of-the-art processing plant.
Yeah, invest in your potential and improve your margin, all the
everything.
Things.
And you could do that as a separate entity to separate liabilities. And it would be a value add to the state. So you could do private label for a lot of other people within the state. But more importantly, when you turn the lights on day one, you know you've got, you know you have capacity that's already kind of that's going to be given to Anthem Snacks.
Yeah.
So
yeah. So you get to this point where you're like 8 months out of your MBA or your business school, and you're like, this is potentially the direction we want to go in. How do you land on beef jerky?
Again, it was really figuring out, okay, I'm here. I'd already did all this research. I was putting together all the research and the marketing ideas for what we were going to do at the plant level to really build a brand anyway. Because the plant was just behind the scenes. We were going to build a brand.
Yeah.
I think it was called like Meats of Montana or something, right? So it was going to be everything. And jerky and meat snacks was the category that was the cleanest to me, which was just you ordered the beef. You're going to buy rounds. You're going to do that. And then there's a process with the smokehouses. And then you got to have your recipe and turn it out. And once you do that, it's the distribution is retail, right? You could do online, but everything else had to be subscription boxes and you're in the middle of COVID. So you're like, what's going to work? What's not going to work? You know what I mean? There's a lot of trade-offs here. And to me, jerky was the most straightforward out of all the things, because otherwise I would have to, you know, hire a bunch of salespeople to sell regionally, into Albertsons or something with cuts. Mm. It just got super messy.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It makes sense. And you land on Anthem. Walk me through the branding and the marketing. What, how did you conceptually come up with those elements? Even the logo.
Yeah. So it really started with, you need something to trademark, and mm-hmm. you're just going down the list. What can you even trademark, right? Mm. And I'm sure you've been on the same process, but you have to go, you know, specific by your category and see what's available. Mm. And so that starts right there. And then at the time, the national anthem stuff was going on, the kneeling for the national anthem. That was a big thing at the time. So I wanted something. I didn't want something, you know, like a screaming bald eagle, which just said like veteran owned or something. Mm. I wanted something a little bit more nuanced. And so it was a combination of two things. It was the national anthem going on. And one of my favorite books is the Ayn Rand anthem book, which is, you know, kind of a dystopian time when, you know, you're kind of rediscovering your individuality during dark ages, which seemed mm-hmm. like we were headed there. If you fast forward 3 years, it's definitely headed there. But so it was really that combination. And so we kind of landed on that. And then the logo is really some horns with an M for Montana. At the time, it was going to be possibly meats. I wasn't sure if it was going to be snacks. And so we just kind of landed on that.
Yeah, it's a great brand. And being a connoisseur of meat, I'm known for being a connoisseur of meat. Like I my kids eat, whether it's like the steer, the Wagyu steer that we butchered on property, elk, deer, whatever. It's the focus of protein in my household is high quality, because I'm not going to compromise, right?
Right.
Every once in a while, Chick-fil-A I'll throw at them, but I'm not compromising off of the protein that my kids eat, my family eats, or I eat. And I noticed, I can't remember how it went down, but like they gave me your bag. You might have handed me the bag, and I was like, oh, okay, beef jerky. And I tasted the honey one.
Yep.
And I was like, man, dude, this is actually really different than all the beef jerkies I've had. Usually they're too dry, they're too salty, they're just not good.
Yep.
And yours was different out of the package as being a higher quality in taste. How do you bridge that gap, and why is that? Like, you go to what it was like Jack-o-Links or whatever, it's like the gas station stuff, that stuff's garbage.
It's
literally like dog food. And I grew up traveling on the road 260 plus days, early days of Philcraft, teaching all over the country. Because I was keto at the time, I would just eat beef jerky and drink Monster energy drinks, and it was garbage. Your stuff was just different. How'd you land on that?
Yeah. So without going too much into the cycle, because it's really about the quality of the meat you buy, right? So, and you could buy all kinds, right? We buy mostly inside cut rounds. Mm. So it's about the quality of meat, which is whole muscle jerky, to get to jerky. And then look, you got to get to lethality when you do it. So you got to get to 160 degrees, but how you get there, it's just like if you were going to, you know, go out in your grill in the backyard, you could put it at 500 degrees and get to, you know, whatever you're trying to get to, or you could slow cook it. Mm. We slow cook it. So you're going to cure it.
So it's like brisket. Yep, it's like slow.
Yep. So it's, you cure it, which is already going to take you that lets the meat bloom. And then that actually, you know, you do that for 12 plus hours, and then you actually cook it, you slow cook it. That takes time. And then once you get, you put it in the drying rack and you let it dry for another, it's an intense process.
Seems arduous as a process.
Yeah.
Especially in scale.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you manage that? I mean, how do you go from that? God, that whole business plan scares the hell out of me. Cause it's like, you know, when you activate a market, even with Philcraft stuff, we could only do so much marketing, because if we overmarket, then we're just going to have a lot of pissed off people who don't have, they're demanding it. We don't have the supply.
Yep.
But for you, when you go out and you're like, even talking to retail, and they're like, yeah, we'll take a PO. As soon as they turn on the PO, depending on the PO they turn and the burn rate that burns through the retail, that's a dilemma for you to have on the back end.
Yes.
So I imagine like you have to stockpile a crap ton of jerky on the back end. How do you balance that supply chain?
Yeah, it's been a lot of lessons learned. So I'm bootstrapping this whole thing. So I can't even, first of all, there's a shelf life to jerky, right?
Yeah.
It's about 18 months.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah. So, well, our jerky is anyway.
Yeah. That's in package. It's about 18 months.
Yep. In 18 months. That said, you don't want to give somebody, you have to have a certain shelf life left by the time it gets to the retailer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you want to give them the freshest jerky.
Yeah.
So you're trying to not do just in time, because to your point, you need to have inventory. But I don't have big money behind me, so I can't also afford to just, you know, let a bunch of jerky sit around and hope for a PO. So it is a process. I'll give you what we went through in the last 3 weeks. We got a PO. We're going to be in 1,700 Lowe's home improvement stores.
Oh my God.
That's about 10,000 cases of jerky. That's about 120,000 actual bags of jerky. And I had to ask for a little bit more time, just because you have to do on the load in, and then you need to have enough on the back stock.
Yeah, because you immediately have to turn the inventory, because when it lands, it could be scarfed up immediately.
Yep. Well, that goes straight into the stores, and then based on the take rate and whatever amount they're anticipating, about a 4 week supply, you got to have another 15%. And then even that, you better have like more jerky ready, because you can't make it fast enough for when the PO comes in for like a 3 week lead time. So we didn't get there overnight. We started with Town Pump has like 100 gas stations in Montana. So we kind of, you know, cut our teeth there. Then we worked in, we did it with United Airlines. We were on United for 18 months.
Really cool.
Yeah. We were doing almost 100.
Were you in the units. Snack basket?
No, or? we were doing the onboard retail. So you'd actually pay.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So we were doing about 100,000 units a month. Again, same thing. And we couldn't afford to wait for the PO. We just had to be ready. And then we got into Wawa, which is about 950 stores. So by the time we got to Lowe's, like, we kind of knew where we were on this thing.
Yeah.
But it's still a fire drill when it happens, you know? I mean, you are pressing go on a lot of things, and then you try to mitigate it by not doing too many flavors. Like, let's land on a couple flavors and let's kind of mass produce that piece.
Yeah, you don't want to do too much.
No.
And then how are you building the back end in scale? Are you finding more reliable meat partners on the back end that could increase your supply, or are you using one source?
No. So one location? The other thing I learned out of doing the meat process, when I walked away from the meat processing deal, is the original idea was Montana meat. And I just figured out very quickly, you can't, yeah, you'd have to educate
impossible.
The market, and it's impossible.
Yeah.
So we do regionally. So, you know, you're talking about Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, even up to Washington and everything else. And I used to try to, broker and buy the meat myself. Nightmare. Especially during COVID.
Because there's margins on it, right? You're like negotiating for a margin.
It's like future
that
commodities.
Changes. Yeah, that changes every day.
Yeah.
It's like stock.
And you're trying to jump. It's exactly right. It's like trying to be a hedge fund guy with no experience. Like,
yeah,
you're an idiot if you try to do
with
that.
With no understanding of the predictions of the future and your scale.
You know what I mean? And then cool. You're trying to negotiate it. So I gave up all that. Look, when we found our partners to do this, I needed somebody who knew what they were doing, and I leave that all up to them. And so now sourcing the meat, all that stuff. Now we are looking for, you know, we're all constantly always looking for more sources, but as long as it's regionally, as long as it's American beef, and as long as, you know, we're buying the cuts we want to buy, that's good for us.
Yeah. So, cause I was AJ Richards is the guy, John, is that the guy's name? AJ Richards, the guy that does the meat stuff. I did a podcast with him talking about the meat supply and how it's a big disaster. I think that's him. He just commented on one of my posts on food shortage, which is, I'm kind of concerned about. I mean, out of all the things that are going on in the world.
It's a concern.
Yeah, I was watching a documentary on photography stuff last night. And it had old photos from the Great Depression.
Yeah.
And it had a photo, which I posted on my social media, of lines in Times Square in 1932 of people
for
bread and soup, just trying to eat. And it talks about the strategic national stockpile of how much stuff we have in stockpile from the federal government. But that doesn't include any food. I mean, FEMA farms the food, but it's not food for the country. If there's an emergency, it's food for the country. If there's a specific disaster, like predictive measures. And he says on his comment on mine, AJ Richards is a.j_Richards. He says 85% of our meat supply chain is made of four companies and 20 slaughterhouses. With as many as they slaughter daily, it's just a few of them closed for any reason. It would cause significant supply chain issues. It would be a really great idea to create personal relationships with your local ranchers and farmers. Let them know who you let them know you have their back, and they will have yours.
It's 100% true. I mean, yeah. Even without the food shortage, just when we went through COVID, those same four that control pretty much the entire market had a monopoly on pricing, and you know, meat skyrocketed during that time.
What does that mean? That means that the small meat processing facility has a percentage of their supply going to those big vendors, mm-hmm. and then they partition a percentage of it for guys like you.
Yeah. And yeah. So the issue ends up being they really control the market. So the guy at the low end, the guy that's actually giving the meat most of the time,
yeah.
he has no leverage in the market, right? Because he's got one big buyer that sets the price on one side. And that one big buyer also sets the price to the consumers. So he's playing arbitrage, really.
Oh, right? Wow.
Yeah.
Are you getting to negotiate? I'm interested in like the numbers from your side. I imagine if it's like, because I think Tyson's one of the big yep, ones.
Tyson, JBS.
So if you have Tyson and they're setting the price, do they expect the smaller player who wants percentage of the capacity to come in higher? Or are they at that point just like negotiating with you and you're getting not the bottom end, but you're getting whatever's left over in the capacity?
So I actually don't deal with Tyson, right? I go straight yeah. to, we go straight to kind of the brokers that work directly with the ranchers.
Yeah.
So we're not going through that process.
Oh, so you're dealing with a broker.
Yeah, yeah. We're dealing with brokers and we're on the open market, but we have relationships with the ranchers. Like we're not going through the Tysons of the world, because otherwise you're just going to get, you're going to get box meat and you can't really speak to like the quality of that stuff. So
yeah.
we're not going through that. But to your point, as far as a country, we are. Right? Like that is what's happening as a country. Like we're going through those four big meat processing plants.
What's your biggest concern in business as it relates to supply chain and just all the things that you've seen and are dealing with? What is it that could hurt your business the most? I always think food,
yep.
especially supply chains in American food is scary. I mean, it's because it's like there's always the potential of something falling apart.
So I'll tell you what we went through, because remember the back half of 21 was a mess for logistics.
Yeah, that's true.
Thankfully, our product is made in America, so we don't have to deal with what a lot of people dealt with, you know, getting stuff from China and stuff like that. So that part's good. The part that it's almost a snowball effect as we've grown. What we were going through then is you do a contract. Once you sign a contract with United Airlines, you have to deliver on a set price.
Yeah. Well, or you get penalized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you don't get penalized. They get
drop you. Yeah. Yeah.
So not only do you have to have the supply, which is already hard enough to get, but luckily we still had that piece and you know, everything's in America. So that part we could still lock up. It was hard. The hardest part was you're not getting locked in pricing when you buy the meat. You're getting spot pricing because inflation at the time was just all over the board, whether it was lumber, whether it was meat, anything. And so you're agreeing to a price over here for 12 months and you're buying. You don't know what tomorrow's price is and you don't know how much to buy. And so at some point your margins get really squeezed, right? Mm. And that doesn't account for, you know, freight or anything else that's also getting jacked up at the time. So there's the supply chain to the meat that will become a problem as we grow because you've got to lock up, you know, more and more. But the spot pricing is also a big deal because now you have to negotiate, have a little bit of room on your margin, and you have to look through 12 months and say, hey, if this thing goes up, you know, whatever lumber went up at the time, whatever even meat was going up, if this thing goes up 15 or 20% by the time this contract's done, are we under, or are we still profitable?
Oof.
Right? And that's tough because you're dealing with corporate America who expects you to deliver and do all these things and you get one shot at that. And so you have to look through and say, even if we deliver and break even, I'd rather have that. And we delivered for them when other people weren't delivering, because you're only gonna get one shot. You're trying to replace really big brands off the shelf, and they're going to give you a shot, and you need to shine. If you don't shine, you know, you're not going to get another shot at this.
You went the distribution and retail model. I assume most of your stuff is big box retail. I mean, you have like a couple accounts, like we have an account with you guys, which is small, obviously, in comparison to big players. Why did you choose to go that route versus direct to consumer when it comes to like a product like this?
So initially I tried going direct to consumer because it was COVID. I mean, people were laughing at me. I was like, hey, I've got a meat snack company. They're like, never heard of you. Nobody's buying right now. It's the middle of COVID. So I put pretty much a glorified brochure, build a website, just because I didn't want to keep answering the same questions, right? Just make sure you get the brand across. The hard part was obviously social media changed and kind of the dynamics of Facebook and all that. And we were late to social media because, you know, that thing kind of took off already. The LTV, so the lifetime value of the customer to the customer acquisition cost ratio for Jerky, just, I could not figure it out. It's not like you're going to spend a lot of money to acquire a customer, but I'm not selling them a $200 item or following up with, like, you know, what you guys do, which is, you know, a complimentary item that fits, you know, kind of the preparedness. Mm-hmm. You're selling a convenience item and then you have to go and earn them again and again and again.
Yeah.
And so it was, and I have to, and so I, that part I just knew was going to take time. And because I don't have big money behind me, I didn't have time to figure that out.
Yeah.
Then there's the small businesses, which are good, except I don't have an army of salespeople to go knocking on every single door. Mm. So to me, the easiest thing to do was just find one buyer who had a lot of stores.
Yeah.
And convince the one buyer that we're a fit for what they do. Mm. And I had to make sure, you're not going to compete against these big guys. They do rebates, they do slotting fees, like it's pay to play. Yeah. It's just really hard to get in.
They have the best margin.
They got the best salespeople that are constantly. So I, you know, when they zig, you zag, right? I went for something that was asymmetric on the upside, which is, okay, where can we compete where they're not competing or they can't bully us out? So airlines was one, home improvements was another, gyms possibly. You know, there's a couple of categories where I thought we can make some headway. So Shields is one, outdoor sporting goods, all that. Where can we make headway where we think we're a fit with their customer, where we're not going to get bullied by Jack Links or Oberto or one of these big guys? Mm-hmm. And so that's where we spent our early time. And then, like anything, everybody wants to be part of a winner. So you just kind of keep knocking these things down. And then by the time you show up to a C store, you know, convenience store, they know who you are and they see that you're kind of trending or you're hot or whatever. And then they just want to be part of it. I don't have to convince you at that point. I mean, I do, but not to the same degree.
Yeah, it's like Prime. I mean, yeah, obviously, he doesn't have to do any convincing because he's got the marketing apparatus outside of the space to bring people in the door.
That's correct.
I mean, hell, they're leaning on him to do the marketing for him.
You see the same thing with Mr. Beast.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Dude, it's like that chocolate company. It's like, oh, my God, dude. Like, all those guys are beating on the door to just get the opportunity to play. So I've seen both sides of your business where you've grown in marketing and education, and then also in distribution retail. I've never done basically retail. We had one opportunity to do it and we failed because we didn't have the inventory. I mean, we got a Sportsman's Bass Pro, which was great. And then the Bass Pro deal didn't happen. So we lost Bass Pro. But then even with Sportsman's, we were like, we can't even fulfill your PO because it was during that time where we couldn't get anything in. And this is a South African manufacturer. Yeah. It was just a pain. And if I manufactured it here, we wouldn't have the points to even get in the door.
Yeah.
So it's a very difficult thing, but you seem to have figured it out. What is the biggest success on in business for you? What has it been? Is it revenue? Is it branding? Is it recognition? What do you take as the biggest success?
Yeah, I mean, we're a for-profit, so I base everything on a P&L to start, right? And so I wanted to make sure we could show that the model was profitable. That was first and foremost. Now, that being said, because I'm bootstrapping, I don't have a lot of overhead and everything when I started out. This past year, I've made that investment, you know, to actually do that, right? We brought fulfillment in-house. We've done a lot of other stuff in-house. So to me, it's a combination of the two, right? One, just pure growth on a revenue standpoint, not even profitability, just pure
growth.
Yeah, because that shows like there's a fit within the market in a very mature, it's not as, you know, it's not as crowded as like coffee, but it's a very mature market, right? With some incumbents that are definitely well established. Mm-hmm. So the fact within 3 years we've made that much headway means it speaks to the brand itself. Without getting too, you know, diving too much into like the marketing aspect of the storytelling, the brand's working, right? We know it's working. At this point, it's about compounding the things that we know are working and just getting better and not making the same mistakes. I think that speaks to, because I can't do everything well and I'm not going to try to do everything with the limited resources we have. So to me, it's really doubling down on where we know it's working, kind of rinse and repeat and get better at telling your story. And so this year we've added on like the UFC piece to it, where we've done, you know, we're the official jerky or meat snack of the UFC. That's like another layer, which just again shows that the brand's working, right? Like more than just we're in, you're not going to see that the back end on the sales piece for, you know, another year or something. But I know it's working because they found us. You know what I mean? So if they find us and they think we're a good fit with their brand, that means there's something to the brand more than just the revenue piece, right?
Yeah. And I think the it's crazy because how this works, especially with a product. Obviously, if you had a good marketing plan and your product sucked,
yeah,
it would be the end of the road. And here we are years later. I mean, we I think the last time I mean, I saw you in the airport recently, but we met years ago. And the our position with you guys started with, holy crap, this is a great product. I don't know anything about the brand, but the product is amazing. So I think that's where you're closing the gap. Is honestly, there's not really good products. I think those branding as they scale, it's like Coca-Cola, they get so big and they have a tested, you know, in the market, they have a tested product that's just getting by. And then they start dropping ancillary products and it sucks.
No.
And the market sees that immediately. It's like you have to do all the things right. You have to position, you have to market, and then you have to have the home run for the product. But dude, your product's so much better than everything else on the market. Like it's, nice. I think by a long shot. I mean, there's nothing that I've tasted where I'm, and it's weird because I'm like, what is in this? Like we've actually asked and joked around, like, dude, there's got to be something illegal in this because this is so dang. It's like Mexican Coke. It's like Mexican Coke versus everything else. It's like you guys are the Mexican Coke of beef jerky, and I'm like, dude, this is amazing. How do you grow from here? Like what? I like the idea of like UFC finding you because that's the right market, right? It's like guys like meat, you know, they like protein, they like their diets or whatever, and they like representing America, Montana, all that stuff. How do you evolve in this? I mean, you get this, the world's your oyster right now, but how do you evolve in this?
Yeah. Look, we've come out with new products. I'll give you one example. So we obviously extend the jerky line itself. I think it's important to have your staple flavors. And then I think it's important to introduce some unique flavors like the smoked honey. We did a bourbon with Willie's Distillery, which was, you know, bourbon, not like bourbon flavoring, right?
Yeah.
So we do kind of bootleg this thing. We have to bring all the bourbon over to do the whole thing. So making sure your customers have unique flavors for the product that keeps having the same consistency. And then we've done a zero sugar, which is really more geared towards kind of people with more health conscious than that. Mm-hmm. But zero sugar doesn't sell that well in retail. It does well kind of online and stuff like that. We're going to be introducing sticks here in January.
Ooh.
So we'll do an all beef sticks. We'll be starting with four flavors. We've been doing the R&D on that piece. That'll be more of the better for you category.
Mm-hmm.
So
are you doing the big sticks?
So we're going to start out. No, we're going to start out with the individual 1 ounce sticks. And then we're going to. So just kind of what you think of for. I'm really going after chomps, to be honest with you.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll start there. And then we've talked about doing maybe a 2 ounce stick, like a fatty stick from Sweetwood or something like that. But we just want to introduce the sticks because at this point we've already have the relationships with the C stores. If the brand's doing well, here comes some more products.
They need to evolve. Yeah. Yep. More variables.
And then that gives us a, you know, whether we want to go into CrossFit or we want to go into something else, it gives us another avenue.
Oh,
it fits
cool.
Nice. Yeah. It fits nice with the UFC, with what they're doing at the PI, the Performance Institute and stuff like that. So we'll have fighters. That's a natural kind of evolution of where we're going to go. But I specifically named the company Snacks because we could do a lot of different things. I just don't want to confuse the market early on.
Yeah.
Say like you do everything. Like,
yeah. Stick to meat and then diversify, right?
Yeah. So we'll stick with protein, you're right. And specifically meat and beef and all that, and maybe go game. But I think from there, you can get into a lot of things. I mean, I almost launched Trail Mix at one point, you know, it was just in the middle of COVID, and it was actually harder to do trail mix than it was to do beef jerky because the nuts all come from all over the world.
Yeah.
It was impossible at the time.
Yeah.
And so I was like, what am I doing this for? Like, this is, I'm going to confuse the market. Let's just focus again, staying disciplined and not doing too many things and just saying, let's just do this one thing really well, establish our brand. Going back to your other piece, there's only a couple ways to innovate in my space, and it's really storytelling and packaging. The product has to be good when they taste it. So that you could do all that other stuff right, and if the product's garbage, it's garbage. But that being said, you know, it is a commodity. It is meat. you know, somebody's probably going to make as good a jerky or something as you down the road. All those things are, you know, they're viable and they're real. So you're only going to do, you're only going to innovate in a couple different ways. And if you can establish that brand and get on the shelves, well, to me, you can then come with a lot of other snacks, right?
Yeah. What's the company? They do venison. They do
Epic. Yeah.
I really like their branding, and I like, there's a couple of things that I don't like at all. Like the pork version of what they do is gross, but the venison with like the cranberries and stuff in it, really good. They seem to drop off. I don't know. I haven't seen them.
Yeah, they got acquired for like, I don't know, it was $200 million or something. I can't remember if it was General Mills or one of the big companies bought them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense now.
They're out of Austin. They did kind of drop off.
Yeah.
There's been a couple of them.
I haven't seen them in a long
time. They're still in a lot of places.
Yeah.
It's you know, you see these brands come and go. There's like Crave that I think got acquired by Hershey, which was a disaster. So these brands come and go. It's hard to have a story that really resonates in the market and that you can kind of hang your hat on, because there's the barrier to entry. Anybody can really start a jerky company.
Yeah.
The question is, can you scale it, right?
Yeah.
Do you have like an actual, you know, is it sustainable to have like a brand that resonates in the marketplace?
And yeah.
That's been the, you know, that's been the piece that we've been trying to make sure we're staying on top of.
Yeah, it's weird because when you look at retail, there's consumer habits where people walk in, they get a Coke. They don't know the story of Coke. Yep. They just know it's a Coke, right? It's got some historical chronicled history. So they just get it. And there's other options where they go in and they go, oh, I like the way this looks. I'll try it. Right. And then there's other tactics where they heard about your brand because Joe Rogan's eating one during a UFC commentation, and they go into the store and like, I want to get this. Right. I think having, you know, in the startup, especially, like, I don't know any other big brands that are big brands, like the Cokes of the world, that are going into UFC. Right there. I mean, there's obviously Bud Light that was very controversial with Bud Light going in, but it was like wasn't it like $100 million deal? It was massive. It's like that kind of business. It's like, that's business. I mean, it's an American brand. I hate to tell people that. It's like, yeah, screw Bud Light for making a bad decision, but it's like that employs a lot of Americans. It's an American brand. There's a turnaround point, and you don't have to cancel every business that touches it because they're trying to turn their stuff around. But UFC is unique. Like when I see your brand affiliated with UFC, that's badass. Like nobody's doing that. Like I don't know any. I don't even know if you're considered a small business, but I imagine so. Still,
yeah, we are.
If you're a small business, like I don't know of many small businesses that are even coming close to that.
No, when they reached out, I mean, I honestly thought it was kind of a joke, right? I was like, I mean, I know who they're. At the time, it was Modelo, Jose Cuervo, Monster. It's like, you know, where do we fit in this thing? You know what I mean?
You're like, how much is this going to cost?
I was like, I don't know what you think we do, but we don't do that. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, this little thing, there's not like some big money behind it. So I don't know what perception is, but I'm about to tell you what reality is.
You got to deal with them.
But yeah.
That's so awesome.
I mean, look, it started out, they just thought we were a really good fit.
Yeah.
And they were like, look, let's test it. Let's do it. You know, they had talked to some really big meat snack companies, and for various reasons, it just didn't feel right. It just didn't go through, whatever the case is. But I told them, I was like, hey, look, I'm not testing anything. We either do a multi-year deal or it's not worth my time, because for me, I'm not going to be the reason one of these idiots, you know, one of these corporate, you know, one of these suits over at Jack Link's decides like, oh yeah, we should do that. And then they're just going to bully me out of this contract, you know?
Yeah.
So for me, it was going to be like, we're going to do a multi-year deal.
You want a long-term investor or longer-term investor.
Yeah, yeah. Right. With the, you know, with the commitment that like, I'm kind of in the pole position as we grow this thing, you know? And then look, a big piece of what we do with them is we're coming out with new packaging now where we'll put their marks, we'll kind of integrate it into our design without being like obnoxious about it. But again, that helps get, I'm betting the, you know, the house on this thing, it helps get into retail, because it's like, if they've never heard of me, you know, I mean, Anthem. And even if like, they're like, okay, you're in a Wawa, but that's not like that big or whatever. You know, all these buyers need to risk mitigate, right? Mm. They're not that motivated to make change. Right?
Yeah.
So you have to convince them, well, why would somebody pick up our bag and try something that they've never heard of, right? And there's the veteran-owned element of it, which is a piece, right? That's a way to, I always tell people, it's a way to cut through directly to the consumer because I don't have the marketing dollars these other guys have.
Yeah.
So if you believe in the values, maybe you do, maybe you don't, but it's there. And then the UFC piece is there. And I'm betting between the displays and the signage and the marks and everything that that resonates with the consumer. At least they can try the jerky. And then I'm hoping they have the same experience you did, right? Which is, oh, the jerky's really good.
Yeah, and then they stick with it.
And then they stick with it.
Yeah, I'm disappointed when I go to places and you're not in the store. Seriously. I like literally go in and I'm like, because when I'm on the road, like I'm taking my kids hunting tomorrow, my 2 4-year-olds, it'll be their first elk hunt. And they'll be with daddy out in the field and I got a cow tag and I'm stoked for it, but I know it's a long, it's like a 7-hour drive. And if I don't pre-pack everything out, the little mom and pop shops that I run into in the middle of Wyoming, they're not going to have your stuff. So I need to, I think it's cool that you do direct to consumer as well, right?
Yeah.
Are you doing a membership?
We do a subscription.
Oh, you do a sub?
Yeah.
Subs are hard, man.
Yeah.
It's so difficult to do subs. Yeah. So difficult. But I get it. It's like if I'm going to order, I mean, I have Liquid Death, the carbonated water on subscription because like I don't like normal water. If I have to have like, I'm bougie enough and set in my ways where I just like, I want a Liquid Death and it's a big can of water. Keeps me hydrated. I need to get your beef jerky on order.
Dude, those guys are crushing it.
Oh, they're, dude.
I'm in the middle of, I don't know if we're going to raise a round or not because I go back and forth if we should, you know, I mean, this is kind of a land grab. You need to like really.
Yeah.
And I talked to one of the investors in Liquid Death and I saw like, it's insane. Yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Just like, it's aluminum, you know, I mean, and we all know the deal with them, but they're crushing it.
Yeah. They're crushing it. And good marketing.
Great marketing.
You know, I mean, Death the Plastic, I think was their, their murdering plastic.
Yeah, yeah. They've done it.
It's smart, so, man. It's smart tactics. But you're playing the long game and you haven't been in the game that long and you're crushing it, seemingly.
Yeah. No, I appreciate it. I mean, again, we're just trying to get better at the decisions we make given the past. So when we go into sticks, and I'm in a different position than when I did jerky, right? When I did jerky, I had to find a way to do this at scale, not knowing anything. Well, sticks, I have an idea. Like we went through the jerky process. So I understand what this looks like. And I don't want to make some of the same mistakes we made in jerky on scaling.
Right? Yeah.
And so hopefully the learning curve on that piece is going to be, you know, it's going to be a little bit faster and better than it was on jerky. And so when you model this thing out, you know, it looks pretty good going forward. You know, I'm playing the long game.
You're not the face of your company.
I'm not.
Smart. I wish I would have did that. I wish I would have thought about that 8 years ago.
My marketing person would disagree with you.
No, it's, well, it's, it would be a cool position for you to do that, but you're not pigeonholed by it, man. I mean, if even 20% of your business was because of your face and you stepped aside, became a founder, it got acquired, and that hurt the business 20%. It's like, dude, that's a bad protocol to even start a business. So like, if I can go back from the beginning, it's like, I like front running messaging and doing content, but I don't want to be known as, I mean, the 50 employees that I have, like contracted and or full-time and subcontracted, it's like, that's Philcraft. That's the grind. I don't want any part of that.
Yeah, but the question is, would you be where you are today without doing what you did?
True.
Because it's very expensive, right?
Yeah.
You have to go get influencers. All these people that are playing really telephone with your messaging instead of coming straight. I think part of what you guys do, the authenticity, is it comes straight out of your mouth. That's a big piece of it that nobody knows what to believe in the market because there's a lot of money sloshing around, you know, pretending to have values and you don't know exactly, you know, what the intentions are behind it. But so when you hear from an owner, it's important. And I think it's a big piece of what you guys do.
Yeah. I tell people often as a entrepreneur in the business history of it, like if you don't have startup capital, you can't just pay to play. You have to organically communicate that from your position. Like I'm in the warehouse, I'm packing the bag, I'm doing the marketing. And when you do that, it's cool because it gives you a story and people get to follow it from the ground up, which we've been, you know, for a long time now, people have been following that story. There's cool things that happen from that and also crappy things. Like people are always like, you make one slip up, they judge you for that. And then they want to cancel you. It's like, you don't know the CEO of Campbell Soup is like, you don't judge that when you go pay, you know, buy all your groceries and then you, the whole entire cart is full of products from marketing from different companies that you have no affiliation with, but you're going to judge me on one thing and not buy my first aid kit or whatever. It's like, man, that's tough.
Yeah.
That's a tough position to be in.
So I made the conscious decision for two reasons. One, I'm not a personality. That's just, I'm not you. I can't do probably what you do anyway.
You're so smarter than me though.
So there's that piece of it. The second piece of it is once I realized that this was not going to be, at least to begin with, a D2C play, you know, D2C direct to consumer play, it was going to be a retail play.
Mm-hmm.
I really sat there and I was like, okay, well, does anybody really care what I have to say? And even if I appeal to the consumer, meaning my value system and what we're talking about, the buyer may have different value systems because they represent all the different brands.
Yeah.
And to your point, am I going to get canceled, right, over something really stupid that may resonate with the consumer, the end user or the end, you know, consumer buying our product, but you got to go through some buyer. And I could tell you the buyers are the buyers, right? The spectrum of buyers that you have that need to fit into their corporate friendly, all that other stuff. So for me, it was just like, I don't have the time to be honest. Because we have a really small team, I had to do a lot of the sales stuff early on. So it just didn't make sense, right, for me at that time. But I always do worry that I don't know if everybody knows this is a small business, right? This isn't, you know, some money propping up something. I try to get that through, or we try to get it through on the messaging through our giving back piece. So you can at least see like, hey, here's the receipts for what we're saying we do. So maybe it's not the owner necessarily that you're, you know, learning everything about. But here are the causes and here are the values.
Oh, yeah. Dude, that's a perfect position. That's a lot cleaner. I mean, the bottom line is like, just like preparedness, you know, disaster we say is an equal opportunist. It doesn't matter what political line you come from.
That's right.
If you're an American, you should be getting this education. Just like with beef jerky, it's like, do I care about your political affiliation? Because you vote for this person not this person, doesn't mean you deserve to eat my beef jerky? Like a lot of people get nuanced and they get very uber focused on their team winning. And it's like, if you have that mentality, especially in business, I mean, there are lines to draw in the sand, no doubt.
For sure.
But overall and ultimately, the majority of the play is like, dude, this is an American brand. This isn't like a political brand. I'm not trying to politically affiliate. I actually hate all that talk. Me trying to fight for the marketing position that if you're into preparedness, you're not a tinfoil hat guy. You're not crazy. You're not anxious. You're not paranoid. Dude, what a dilemma to start a business in. Because I'm like, the whole thing I message is trying to start and say, hey, preparedness is for you. It doesn't matter who you are. And I can imagine that, you know, if you just affiliate with the right nonprofits, if you affiliate with the right companies, that work is done for you through them.
Yeah, that's
which is
correct.
Really cool.
So first off, look, you start a new category, so it's completely different.
Yeah.
You have to educate a market on what something is. When you start a new category, just by definition, you're outside the box.
Yeah, no historical.
It's easy
on that
for them
one.
To paint in whatever picture they're going to do.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have that issue because we're just a jerky company. But to your point, which is why we work with companies like you, right? Like we have our value system. We care about the things we care about, and we speak through those outlets, you know, and who we actually do business with. But it just doesn't make sense at a kind of strategic level to be on the shelves. Nothing good's going to come out of me saying something from my personal belief, right? Nothing good's going to, unless we really cross lines, right? Anything like American or whatever. But the political system is so ridiculous right now. To get caught up in that, when what I should be doing is our mission is, you know, we give 10% of our profits back. And we don't run this one, you know, this whole thing where we draw down, there are no profits. Like we gave over $100,000 in 22. Those are the receipts to show these are the values we have, and then let the people we work with kind of speak on our behalf of the values that they have along with us, you know, alongside of us.
I love that, man. You're so much a better entrepreneur than me.
No.
I wish I would get my MBA.
I could tell you that for anyone out there, don't bother.
Yeah. What helped you most in business, wrapping this up? Like what was the number one driving factor that got you down the entrepreneur path and that helped you? What was it in life?
Honestly, it was my time on a team. Honestly, I mean, doing more with less.
Yeah.
Just being on a team where you're...
We didn't even talk about your military background, but could you tell people about your military background?
So I signed up after 9/11, joined 2003, got out 2009. I was in 3rd Special Forces Group. I was on the Halo team, got wounded my last trip to Afghanistan.
We probably should have started the podcast with that. Let's just edit that in the beginning.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
But so my team time was extremely helpful. I mean, just figuring out in a corporate setting, because I made the transition to civilian life, and you know, everyone's trying to jockey for positions on how to kind of climb the corporate ladder. Well, you're coming from a team. You're not worried about that. You have a mission.
Yeah.
Everyone's setting out to do that one thing to achieve that goal. And then you are improvising. Look, you're going to commit, you're going to adapt, you know, all that stuff, but you have a plan, whether you call the frag or not, you are going to improvise and make a decision what's best for. And look, this is easy compared to that. It's not life or death. You know what I mean? So just taking those learnings, trusting the conviction you have, putting in the hard work. I got all that from team time.
I love that, man. I love your story. I love your company. I certainly love your meat, which is weird to say out loud. We'll use that as the real.
Yeah.
I love his meat. I appreciate you coming in, man. Where can people actually go to get Anthem snacks?
So you can go to Shields. You can go to Wawa if you're in any C stores. We actually just came in. If you ever go see a hockey or basketball game in DC, we're in the arena over there. We're going to be in 1700 plus Lowe's and a bunch of other places, but we're working on getting everywhere. But otherwise, just at Anthem Snacks for Instagram, and then anthemsnacks.com if you want to come get a subscription.
And you can pay for the product on anthemsnacks.com.
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome, man. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Cool.